From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a look at the proposed 2020 city budget for Milwaukee. It's not pretty.
What the mayor and the council and the budget team is faced with is the need to somehow have no increase in spending for all of the general city purposes, yet there are costs to continue from salary increases and other factors. So something has to be cut.
Then a look at The Infiltrators, which features the true story of undocumented immigrants working to save people from deportation. Education writer Paul Tough dismantles the myth of college as a pure meritocracy. And author and journalist Paul Hendrickson says, yes, architect Frank Lloyd Wright wasn't a very nice person, but his new book implores you to look further.
You cannot go away from looking at these buildings without appreciating there is a fundamental soulfulness at work.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. People often jokingly refer to extra seasons in the calendar year. It could be road construction season, or if you're up north, maybe mud season. But one extra season that comes around to all Wisconsin municipalities and counties every year, without fail, is local government budget season. No license necessary. Since budgets are in season right now, the Wisconsin Policy Forum did what it does every year as well, take a deep dive into the proposed Milwaukee county and city budgets. Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and he says this year the county caught some fortuitous breaks, but the city is struggling to cover soaring pension costs. Henkin sat down with WUWM's Angelina Mosher-Salazar to help us unpack the proposed budgets.
Rob, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back.
When you came on the show last year to talk about the 2019 budget, you explained to us that surprisingly, there weren't many fireworks. And it seems like the 2020 budget is also absent of a lot of controversy. Am I correct?
You are correct. So yes, it was really quite remarkable last year at this time when we commented at the fact that for Milwaukee County, we have seen several successive years of really grueling budgets with very difficult decisions over proposals for new revenue streams coming from a vehicle registration fee, for example, to privatization initiatives, to really significant cuts in public safety and transit and other services. Last year at this time, we remarked that a variety of fortuitous circumstances had sort of coalesced to make the 2019 budget not that bad. And surprisingly, because we were hearing a lot of concern over the summer from the county executive about potential for things like cutting bus routes and potentially having to look at delaying or deferring permanently some capital projects in parks. We were expecting a pretty challenging budget for 2020, but as it turns out, the 2020 recommended budget also is relatively calm.
Now, could you just unpack for us why? Like, what are the factors that make the 2020 budget relatively calm?
So there were a variety of different good news items that sort of coalesce toward the end of the budget process. But I think the two key ones to talk about are, first of all, the discovery that the county's capacity under state law to levy property taxes actually grew by $2.9 million unexpectedly. So whereas initially the county thought it had the ability to maybe raise property taxes by about $3.9 or $4 million, it turns out that in the recommended budget, there's an increase of $7.4 million. That's due to this newly found $2.9 million of extra capacity. It's essentially unused capacity from previous years, plus a couple of other circumstances. Now, obviously, county leaders need to decide whether they want to take advantage of the availability of this extra cap space. The county executive has done so in his recommended budget, but that provision actually requires a two-thirds vote of the county board. Now, the second important factor is healthcare. Surprisingly, as we head now into 2020, whereas the county originally projected it would have to increase spending on healthcare by about $5.5 million, it actually turns out it can reduce healthcare spending by about $2.2 million.
So definitely a couple of lucky breaks there for the county and balancing the budget.
Yes, so luck has something to do with it. But I think the most important takeaway here is that the availability of these two mechanisms is unlikely to repeat itself in 2021.
44% of that tax levy is going to cover health care and pension costs for retirees. I mean, 44%, that seems quite remarkable.
I would say it is quite remarkable, and it's really the big story when we think about the financial challenges facing Milwaukee County. Promises made to employees who are now retirees many decades ago, promises in the case of health care that were made before anyone had an inkling that health care costs were going to explode to the extent that they did in the previous decade. Lately, that's been more under control, both nationally and locally. Promises in terms of pensions, which have received a lot of attention from Milwaukee County. And so when you think about it, the fact that, again, 44% of the county's single largest local revenue source needs to come off the top immediately to pay for these retirement benefits, that is why the county really struggles to find the resources to support its current array of programs and services. Now, I said that's storyline number one. A close number two is what happens on the revenue side, where the county is extremely restrained by state law from the types of revenue options it can pursue. The county is very reliant on state aids, which have tended not to grow anywhere near the pace of inflation and certainly not near the pace of the county's cost to continue its existing services. So you put those two together and you have a very challenging fiscal situation.
And Rob, you brought up pensions and how that is a huge cost for the county. And I want to use that as a jumping off point to talk about the city's budget, because the mayor went before a common council and he says, listen, by 2023, we are going to be on the hook for about $100 million that we weren't expecting. And that all goes to pension costs. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And it's really difficult for me to overstate the significance of this and the challenge that it is going to pose to city government in the years to come. So in the 2020 proposed budget, the mayor is suggesting that a down payment of $8 million be made. Arguably, that could be higher to prepare for this huge spike in 2023. But think about it, taking $8 million off the top of the city's property tax levy increase, which is a 3.5% increase that would generate about $9.8 million. Well, $8 million of that 9.8 immediately goes toward this pension reserve fund, which sets up a very difficult set of circumstances for the rest of the city budget.
Let's talk about those difficult circumstances for the rest of the city budget, because putting away that money does come at a cost. And I think one of the things that you mentioned in your report is a hit to public safety.
Yep. Essentially, what the mayor and the council and the budget team is faced with is the need to somehow have no increase in spending for all of the general city purposes, in other words, for its departments, yet there are costs to continue from salary increases and other factors. So something has to be cut. And so a decision was made by the mayor in his proposed budget that the Milwaukee Police Department, as the single largest by far source of spending in the city budget, would have to take a hit in 2020. And so there's a proposal for a reduction of 85 positions across the department. 60 of those are sworn police officers. And that's really pretty unique. We have seen public safety and the police department in particular shielded from sizable budget cuts during the past decade by the mayor and the council. And this year would be different.
Let's talk about the DNC. Is the DNC going to be a revenue generator because we have these people coming in, spending money in the city, or is it actually just going to raise costs because we have people coming and using services in the city but not paying taxes?
So it's a great question. And so the 2020 proposed budget anticipates a grant of $50 million from the Democratic National Committee that is ostensibly to cover costs incurred by the city of Milwaukee for the city's hosting of the convention in July. And so on a macro level, clearly, when we just think about the economy of the city of Milwaukee and the region, this is a huge benefit for our region. When we think about city government, your question is a very good one, because to what extent is the money that's coming in directly from the DNC going to offset the cost that the city is going to have to incur for all of the security and all of the additional city services that are going to be required during this period. On top of that, the fact that there is no city sales tax, which means that all of the dollars that are going to be spent by all of these conventionaires, the city is not reaping a direct benefit from that, also sort of creates another variable here. Bottom line is, I think that there could be some benefit for the city of Milwaukee. There's an opportunity here, for example, to use funds from that $50 million to buy new equipment for the police department that is completely justifiable because it's new equipment that will be used to help the city prepare for the convention and keep public safety during the convention. But it's also equipment that the city can then keep and use going forward. And it may indeed be equipment that the city would have had to purchase at some point in the future anyway. So it's really hard to say how all of this is going to shake out. But the hope is certainly that there will be a long-term benefit, not only to the regional and the city economy, but to city government as well.
Rob Henkin, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He spoke with WUWM's Angelina Mosier Salazar. Coming up after a break, we'll talk with a producer of a film that documents the true story of dreamers who gain access to a deportation center and then work to release people from the inside. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Since Donald Trump was elected, there has been an increased focus on the fate of undocumented immigrants in the United States. But long before Trump's ascendancy to the presidency, the U.S. had ramped up deportation efforts. And in 2012, the National Immigrant Youth Alliance decided to fight these deportations from the inside. The film The Infiltrators features several undocumented immigrants, including Marco Saavedra and Viridiana, both activists who turned themselves into the Broward Transitional Center, a detention center for deportees. They enlisted Claudio Rojas, a man facing deportation, and together with Mohammed Mo Abdullahi, their main contact on the outside, they worked to get people released. After the premiere, Rojas was detained and deported, something the filmmakers claim is retaliation for his participation in the film. Darren Dean is one of the producers of The Infiltrators, and he's in town for the screening at Milwaukee Film Festival. Ahead of that screening tomorrow night, Dean spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and he explained some of what attracted him to this film.
I had been watching the news, and I had been hearing about these things. This is so important and so happening right now. And, you know, and it felt very urgent to me, and I felt that regardless of how much I knew or understood about the subject matter, I did feel that there's a responsibility here to step up. Whether or not you know the full story, you just got to get in there and start learning and educating yourself. So much of my education did come, you know, about the process, you know, of these deportations and the process of protecting people from deportations through people like Mohammed and Viridiana, who are two of our lead characters, and Marco, both interviews with them as well as the documentary footage that had been captured and just learning, you know, what we could do. And that was kind of like step one, and then integrating that into this feature.
So what did you learn? What were the kinds of things that you learned about deportation that you found surprising?
Obviously, the complete stripping of human rights, it was and it wasn't surprising. I mean, I feel like you kind of expect that, but the privatization of these, you know, these facilities, because people aren't arrested, there's a very gray area of what is going on. They're detained, they're not arrested. And because of that, I think the thing that I found surprising was through Mo and Viri was the idea that they could get out. They could be released if they knew what to do. The problem is that most of these people who are in there don't know what to do, don't have an access point, don't have a person to get to, don't have a hotline to call, which is what Mo and Viri had set up and Marco had set up in an effort to get people who could find their way to a phone and, you know, at the very least tell a family member, call the National Immigrant Youth Alliance and get me help. And from that, just kind of these things of refuse to get on a plane. There's all these little like nuanced things that according to law at that time, by the way, at that time, because a lot of it has changed and a lot of these tactics don't work. But a lot of these things made it seem really like people could survive this and hopefully get out. And it's increasingly gotten a lot more difficult. But for that period of time, that was the surprise to me, was that people were, you know, especially like Mo and Vera, were intuitive enough to educate the people behind those walls on how to not get deported. And it was working to a certain degree. And obviously a lot of that has changed now under, you know, new eyes.
Yeah. You know, you say a lot of these things have changed. The film really focuses on a time period about 2012.
Yep.
So, of course, Obama is in his second term, starting his second mm-hmm. term in his presidency. What has changed under the Trump administration?
My understanding is, from what I've seen, it's become a lot more divisive and spiteful. You know, now if we say to our president, you know, this can't happen, he goes, na 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 na, yes it can. And that's kind of how we're operating right now. And he's amped up efforts and he's trying to build walls and things that were not part of this in 2012. That being said, it was kept a lot quieter in 2012. This is over, you know, many administrations. So the good aspect of the Trump administration right now, if there is any good aspect of the Trump administration right now, is the fact that Trump has people talking. Trump is a person who will tweet, you know, let's get rid of these guys. Let's, you know, deport all these people and separate them from their families and throw them out of the country. And naturally, our instinct is to go, whoa, what's going on? That's when people start educating themselves. That's when people start taking action. During the Obama administration, there was nobody saying that stuff. It was being done quietly behind closed doors. And it was the same effect. And at one point, there were more people, you know, deported under Obama. But now it's starting to amp up again, you know, because of just whatever kind of crazy world we're in right now.
Inside of the film, and obviously things have changed, but inside of the film, one man was threatened that his family would be deported, specifically his wife, if he didn't agree to his own deportation. How common are these kinds of threats?
From my understanding, they're fairly common. I don't want to spoil the film, but there are elements that if, you know, people come out and see the film that they'll learn about that changed after the film was made, where certain individuals were retaliated against by ICE because they were in this film. That's the kind of threat that they posed to people. So there's nothing stopping them from also going and trying to deport that person's family if they're not, you know, if they're also not legal. The tricky part about this is that from the documentary side, I would say 9 films out of 10, you know, we're going to somebody to talk about the truth. And they need to be protected and be able to say, this is the truth, without a government or an individual being able to come after them for telling the truth. And in the case of this film, I believe, we very strongly believe that I'm a straight white guy from Jersey. No, we here, these are our subjects, have been targeted directly by ICE and our government for speaking out. Right now, we have a lawsuit with the ACLU trying to target, well, actually suing ICE for retaliatory, you know, behavior, because it makes it impossible for any documentarian to go out and get a true story if somebody can then follow through with some kind of action that's going to punish them for telling the truth.
Yeah, the case you're talking about, of course, was in the news, that one of the subjects was deported as a result of being part of this film. And, you know, that gets to a broader question that I have about this film in general. You're dealing with incredibly delicate information, in part because many of these people are undocumented. Many of these people, beyond being undocumented, really don't have a pathway to citizenship in the United States. And thus, this makes them vulnerable.
Absolutely.
How do you deal with that kind of subject matter? How do you work around those kinds of concerns?
Well, I feel like there is, I will just say it's Claudio. I mean, it's our main character. And you know, I feel irresponsible not saying that we need to, you know, try to get Claudio back in this country. And I ask this of myself and of the filmmakers I work with very frequently, because I tend to work in those worlds of social realism so frequently, or even in my narratives, many of our actors are real people. You know, our trans sex workers were real trans sex workers. Our West African street hustlers were real West African street hustlers. You know, so you always kind of walk away, or even, frankly, enter a film asking yourself, what is your responsibility to these individuals? And where does it begin? Where does it end? What is your responsibility after those cameras stop rolling? And arguably, that, you know, the types of films that, you know, I'm involved with, that responsibility goes long beyond, you know, rap and, you know, and a festival premiere and a sale of a film. Claudio, I mean, you know, he has a family here. You know, they feel threatened by this too. And he wants to come home. This is home to him. You know, he's got children and grandchildren who are American. And we have been doing a lot of different things on a lot of different levels. Mo and Vidi, you know, I mean, Mo has, you know, dreamactivist.org. Vidiana has, you know, her own organization that, you know, the National Immigrant Youth Alliance has split sort of at this point. But they have new organizations they're working with to educate people, you know, and to also take action. You know, Mo has kind of set up this new bay of individuals that will take phone calls from inside these detention centers and try to do what we do in the film. But that being said, we all have like different ways of taking action. You know, what do? I can call my senator. I can write a letter. I can, you know, there's certain things that you can do and that I can do and stuff like that. Mo will stage a sit-in and, you know, and there's many levels to take action. And we're trying to take all of these different ways of taking action to try to help Claudio at this point. And there's another piece. On November 7th, there's a hearing in New York City now for Marco. Marco, who is a dreamer and supposedly protected under the DREAM Act, is suddenly now being targeted for deportation. So I'm beginning to wonder how long before they, you know, they try to come for, you know, Mo or Vidi. This is very clearly to me, like the people who are flat out protected. Claudio was not. Marco was under the DREAM Act. And this is very clearly a targeting. So somebody hands me a microphone and says, you know, can film change the world? And you kind of suddenly you see what is happening and you're going like, well, no, this is not what I expected and this is not helping things. And you wonder if you are helping things by going like, here's this man who's undocumented. And then suddenly people come and take him away. It's like, where is that line now? And how do we solve that problem? And I'm not sure what the answer is because I've become a little disillusioned at this point. You know, obviously we press on with our efforts to, you know, to reach out to the government and change things. We just don't know that we can do it in time. I mean, on the flip side of that, from a, you know, practical perspective is, you know, yes, when we enter into an arrangement with our subjects, they know, you know, we tell them that there may be risk and they know the risk. And God bless Claudio and God bless Marco for being willing and Mo and Vidi for being willing to take that risk. But now that the time has come for them to, you know, face the repercussions of that risk because they made our film, it is up to us. And that responsibility doesn't end. And it really is up to us to try to get people involved, just generate that energy to keep these people here, whether it works or not. I mean, eventually it's going to work, but we have to do everything that we can. And so it's a broad answer to a big question, and it's a big question that weighs upon all of us. You know, it's a huge risk. It's a huge risk at this point in this country for anyone to be speaking their mind, period. Especially for these folks. It's particularly challenging and challenging for the people who ask them for the truth.
Yeah. Well, Darren, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Darren Dean is a producer of The Infiltrators, a film that documents the true story of dreamers who gain access to a deportation center and work to release people from the inside. The film has another screening at the Milwaukee Film Festival tomorrow night at 9:30. Dean spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find more of our conversations with filmmakers at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll talk with education writer Paul Tuff, who has a new book that dismantles the myth of college as a pure meritocracy. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. In his new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us, education writer Paul Tuff dismantles the myth of college as a pure meritocracy. Instead, he finds that higher education in the United States reinforces class and racial inequalities. He tells the story with research and data, but also through the personal experiences of young people. Tuff spoke with WUWM's education reporter Emily Files, beginning with a story of one of the students featured in his book, Yvonne Martinez, a first-generation student at the University of Texas in Austin. Martinez didn't have high test scores, but she was still admitted to the elite university. Tuff explains how UT Austin's admission system opens the door for students like Martinez in a way that other flagship universities don't.
So most states, their flagship institutions are actually becoming more and more like selective private institutions. Test scores are becoming more and more important at most flagships. But the University of Texas in Austin is different because 20 years ago, the Texas legislature passed this law called the top 10% rule that is now actually more like the top 6%. So if you are a student in high school anywhere in Texas and you're in the top 6% of your class by GPA, you are automatically admitted to UT Austin. And so you get this class that shows up each fall in Austin that is very different than the classes at other flagships. They're much more diverse because you have the top 6% from, you know, a high school in suburban Dallas, but you also have the top 6% from schools in the Rio Grande Valley where almost everyone is Latino or Latina, from ranching communities, from inner city neighborhoods. So it creates a much more diverse class. And it also means that they don't look at standardized test scores. They can't. They have to admit students who are in the top 6% by GPA alone. So Yvonne was a perfect example of this, right? She had an unbelievable GPA right at the top of her class, but her ACT score was a 22, which is above average, but only a little bit above average and not the kind of score you see in most highly selective flagships like UT.
So what was playing out at UT Austin was the opposite of what had been happening at other elite universities around the country or what has been happening. You write about how admissions at public flagship institutions have trended towards seeking out more wealthy and out-of-state students. So tell me more about the pressures that have led to that.
Mostly the pressures are just money. So state governments in, I think, almost every state in the country have cut their higher education budgets by 15 or 20% just since 2001. Part of it had to do with the recession in 2008, but it was happening before that. And then when the recovery came, funding didn't return. And so we have really changed the way we finance public higher education in this country. It's not very public anymore. We are putting more and more of the burden on individual students and individual families, which means tuition is going up, debt is going up, and the public investment is going down.
It reminded me of a story that I did recently about the Promise program at UW-Madison. You've probably heard about these free tuition Promise programs. And a listener asked us, why doesn't UW-Milwaukee have a Promise program? And administrators there pointed to the difference in the number of Pell-eligible students who would qualify for this type of program. It's about a third of students at UW-Milwaukee are Pell-eligible. At UW-Madison, it's about 14%.
Yes. I mean, the thing to remember about Pell eligibility is you don't have to be very low income. Like about half of high school graduates would be eligible for a Pell grant if they went right on to college. And so, yeah, so flagships like UW-Madison, a lot of them have Pell percentages down in the low teens. So 14% is not out of the ordinary at all. And in lots of cases, the Pell percentages at those flagship institutions are lower than at some private institutions that are similarly selective. So in other words, these public institutions just aren't doing the job that they were founded to do, which is to educate a broad swath of the students with the most potential in that state.
Yeah, that was something new for me. Your description of the Pell eligibility, it's not as simple as saying those are low-income students. And you talk about how elite universities are sometimes disproportionately accepting students who are at the higher range of Pell eligibility, meaning their family income is just below the cutoff. So can you talk more about that and how it relates to the story of Kiki Gilbert at Princeton University?
Sure. So that study, the study about the Pell cutoff, it was done by a couple of economists, Carolyn Hawksby and Sarah Turner, and just came out earlier this year. And it really does sort of stoke the conspiracy-minded theorizing in some of us because, yeah, what they were able to look at precise incomes for different students who had applied to certain colleges. And they saw that a lot of institutions feel like they They don't want people like us to say like, oh, your Pell percentage is so low. So they try to get the Pell percentage as high as possible to give at least the impression that they're educating a really broad range of students. And so if you are just below the Pell cutoff, as rich as you can be and still be eligible for a Pell grant, you're much more likely to be accepted either than students who are genuinely low income or than students who are just above the Pell cutoff. You know, generally, most of the students who are admitted to these institutions are from affluent families, from the top economic quintile. But when they're looking for lower income students, that's exactly where they look, just below the Pell cutoff.
So Kiki Gilbert was a low-income African-American student at Princeton University. Not sure she's still a student there.
She is. She's a junior now, yeah.
Great. But when she arrived there, she was thinking that there would be at least some students who had similar backgrounds to her. But she realized the longer she was there that the kind of poverty that she came from was not common at all among the students at Princeton.
Yeah. So Kiki Gilbert was one of the most remarkable students who I met. I met her when she was just finished with her junior year in high school. And so she's an African-American student. She was living in Charlotte when I met her, Charlotte, North Carolina, and from a really low-income family with a pretty chaotic history and in living in generational poverty in the United States. Mostly what she found was that the way that Princeton put together its class, there was very little room for students like her. I mean, first of all, most Princeton students are affluent. You know, almost three quarters are from the top income quintile. And that when they were admitting low-income students, it was mostly either sort of higher-income, low-income students, students who were very close to that Pell cutoff, or it was or they were more likely to be white or Latino low-income students, that the African-American students who were there were more likely to be from professional families or private schools or the children of recent immigrants from Africa or the Caribbean or all three of those.
So how much does that have to do with the standardized test scores, and how does that affect the students that colleges are accepting?
Yeah, it has something to do with standardized test scores. So, you know, so the SAT and the ACT, there's a big debate about how useful they are in predicting which students will do well in college. But one thing that's clear about them is that your SAT and your ACT score, it correlates strongly with your family background. They are a really good predictor of how much money your family has. And so when institutions put a lot of emphasis on SAT and ACT scores in admissions, it makes it much more likely that they're going to admit a really affluent class. There's this economist, Raj Chetty, who, along with some colleagues, did a report called the Mobility Report Cards paper, which found that those Ivy League colleges have very few students from the lowest economic quintile, from, you know, with the bottom fifth of family incomes. Only about 2 or 3% of the student body was from that bottom quintile. Why that isn't changing, I feel like it is all the kind of incentives in the system are pushing those institutions toward admitting more white and wealthy students. For the first one being that they can pay tuition. The test scores is part of it. There are so many elements in the system that steer institutions toward admitting more and more high-income students.
That research from Raj Chetty about the economic diversity at these elite institutions, the other piece of that that makes it even more depressing is that the Ivy League schools, the most elite schools, are the most powerful drivers of economic mobility for low-income students.
Yeah, it is the real paradox. I mean, certainly in Raj Chetty's work, but just in all of my reporting, that, you know, higher education still is this great vehicle for social mobility for individual students. When a young person like Kiki Gilbert, again, came from very difficult circumstances, no money in her family at all, the fact that she is now at Princeton and going to graduate in a year means she is highly likely to have a really financially successful life. The problem is there are just so few of those students. And most low-income students, I mean, most American college students in general, but certainly most low-income students are going to public universities. Low-income students tend more often to go to community colleges and regional public universities that have the lowest graduation rates. When Kiki Gilbert manages to get to Princeton, their options are great, but very few of them do.
more colleges are becoming test optional, meaning students don't have to submit their SAT or ACT test scores. Marquette University here in Milwaukee recently joined the growing number of institutions that are going test optional. Is that a solution to the inequities that are perpetuated by this reliance on standardized tests to rank colleges in terms of how elite they are?
Well, it might be a solution. I don't think it's the solution. I mean, I think that there are lots of reasons that institutions choose to do that. I feel like the case for considering test scores is that test scores give a small amount more certainty about whether a student is going to succeed at your institution than just looking at their GPA alone. What admissions people who choose to go test optional say is that additional amount of confidence in how well a student will do is outweighed by the inequity that comes along with considering a data point that correlates so strongly with family income. And so I think when you go test optional, it gives you an opportunity to consider a certain type of students like Yvonne Martinez, the UT student we were talking about before, who have great GPAs and lower test scores. It is not a magic bullet. There are still so many incentives in the system that incline institutions to admit more rich kids and fewer poor kids, that going test optional alone doesn't always make a big change in the socioeconomic diversity of a school.
So the reality of higher education being so skewed towards the wealthy and well-connected is pretty discouraging. What gives you the most hope in your reporting and writing of this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two things. One is that I feel like there are more institutions that are at least trying, or at least saying that they're trying to admit a more diverse class. I feel like there is this new sort of public pressure, which I hope the public will keep up on institutions to bring genuine diversity to more and more campuses. And then I think there's also this change that's happening on many campuses about the responsibility of institutions to help students graduate. So the place where I saw this most vividly in my reporting was at the University of Texas in Austin. Over the past 7 or 8 years, they put in a variety of new supports for students, a summer program for first-generation students before freshman year, a freshman sort of learning community that gave especially low-income first-generation students a sense of connection to each other and to the campus, internships and mentoring and counseling. And all of those supports made a huge difference in how students in general did at UT, whether their graduation rates went up by 20 points in just a few years. But they especially went up for those low-income, first-generation, lower-scoring students. What UT shows is if you do sort of just kind of a basic sense of like welcome and making students feel like they belong and recognizing that being a first-generation student or a low-income student comes with additional challenges, if you recognize that and if you put those sorts of supports in place, actually those students are going to succeed at the same level as their higher scoring peers. And so I think you can put those two changes together to create a pretty hopeful picture that if institutions decide to make admissions less dependent on test scores and more focused on real socioeconomic diversity, and at the same time they're offering some kind of pretty basic supports for the first generation and low-income students, you can not only have a more diverse class, you can have a more successful class. And when that happens, higher education goes back to doing the job that we established it to do, which is being an engine of social mobility, being the force that can really help low-income students move into the middle class and middle-class students move into affluence.
Paul Tough is the author of the new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. He spoke with WUWM's education reporter, Emily Files. We'll take one last break and then speak with the author of a new Frank Lloyd Wright book that strips its subject down to the studs. Lake Effect returns right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Even if you're not into architecture, you probably know Frank Lloyd Wright's name. But despite being one of the most famous architects of the 20th century, and despite all of the books written about him and his work, the man himself remains somewhat of a mystery. Even his autobiography was embellished, and historians admit they can never truly verify fact from fiction. Well, one thing that author and journalist Paul Hendrickson thinks has been left out of all the previous accounts of Frank Lloyd Wright is his humanity. The man who was haunted by his buildings and their fates as much as he was made famous for them. Hendrickson's new book, Plagued by Fire, is a sympathetic and perceptive look at Wright that he hopes will change the way people perceive the architect. Hendrickson will be in Milwaukee tonight to talk about the book at Boswell Book Company, but ahead of that, he joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to explain why he took a 7-year deep dive into the life of the famous architect.
I feel I came to him organically, a word that Wright would approve of. I grew up in Kankakee, Illinois, where there were two famous Wright houses, not only in that small town 50 miles below Chicago, but indeed, literally, on the same street I lived on. We lived 5 blocks north, where the average people of the town lived, our barely middle-class family. But 5 blocks down at the river, where the wealthy lived, were these two immense Frank Lloyd Wright houses, especially one, the B. Harley Bradley House, 1900, which is in every Frank Lloyd Wright book. It's a seminal house. It's a kind of precursor to all of his prairie work. It's a St. John the Baptist house. And I, as a 9-year-old in 1953, so you can understand something about my age, would sail past that house on my way to the ballpark with my ball glove hooked on my handlebars of my brand new J.C. Higgins 3-speed, which I got for Christmas that year. Something was pulling me in and simultaneously scaring me about the B. Harley Bradley. But because I'm a slow learner, it only took 6.5 decades to loop around and find me as a storytelling project. The truth is, Audrey, I'm not even sure I knew the name Frank Lloyd Wright in 1953. As the years went on and I became a kind of amateur student of architecture, I began to learn more about Frank Lloyd Wright. But until I started this project, I was in no way, shape, or form any kind of Frank Lloyd Wright expert. What I am is a narrative nonfiction writer who gets obsessively hooked into these projects.
Why did you choose to set the tone of the book off with the fire and murders at Taliesin right here in Wisconsin? It's an interesting way to set the stage.
I think that's a great follow-up question to what you asked. When you said riddles wrapped up inside of riddles, triangles drawn inside of squares, which is what I say in the text, that event, the most iconic and savage event in Frank Lloyd Wright's life, takes place on August 15th, 1914, when this black servant in a white serving tunic, supposed to be ladling out the midday soup, goes inexplicably berserk and tries to roast the place to cinders, and with a shingling hatchet destroys 7 of the 9 lives in that building. Wright wasn't there that day. That event, for a century and more, has remained in some ways at the heart of the inexplicability of Frank Lloyd Wright's preposterously complicated, tortured life. That event, which, you know, the most casual student of Wright might know something about, can stand for so many other events because it is, Audrey, the riddle wrapped inside the square. So I decided as a journalist to try to find out what I could. And I think I went a distance further than most people have ever gone. For one thing, finding out about the black servant who did this. I mean, history has had a hard time getting his name right. It's Julian Carleton. It's been misspelled. It's been misstated. The first 7 words in the Chicago Tribune the next morning were, "A Barbados Negro with a hand axe yesterday." No, he was from our own country. He was from the Deep South. He was from Alabama in a family of 13 or 15 children whose parents may have been born into slavery. So I, as best I could, went to understand whatever I could about that person. It was as if we always had the deed and none of the life. Did I solve the riddle? No. I only got edges and pieces.
There are indeed a lot of riddles when it comes to Frank Lloyd Wright and his life. You know, what's true, what's not. You admit, along with other historians and other people who have studied and wrote about him, that you never know, even if it's his first primary documents, his own accounts, you don't know what is completely truthful or not. And it's noted that, you know, 72 years as an architect and an egoist, you make sure to point that out. So I'm curious with you and taking a deep dive into this man, do you consider other works about Wright that it's reverencing an egoist? How do you balance that, you know, the weight of the work compared to the weight of the man and his personal character?
Yeah, maybe in one sense we could say that the only thing that counts is the work. The only thing that counts is the built work, the architecture that survives. I hear that. But I feel that there is a deeper way to appreciate that architecture through some understanding of the life. But you just hit it on the head again. His life is so difficult to get down. It has been trailed by so many distortions and mistruths, starting with everything that Wright did himself. He was a fantastic prevaricator, a distortionist, a fabulist of his own life. His 1932 autobiography, which I say is one of the great memoirs of the 20th century, even if you must distrust it on every page. I'm an old shoe leather journalist. I worked 30 years in daily journalism, most of it at the Washington Post. I was trying to take nothing at face value. Inadvertently, these mistakes get passed on through each generation, and Wright promulgated so many of them himself in his own lifetime. But the balancing act that you ask about between the egotist and the supreme architect, I tried to approach this with a fundamental respect, even if I needed to challenge every document that I could find at every turn. You know, Audrey, I don't spend 7 years trying to write about someone I don't like. You scrape everything away, all the refuse, all the dross of his ego and his arrogance, his incredible arrogance and his ego. I contend you scrape all that away. You cannot go away from looking at these buildings without appreciating there is a fundamental soulfulness at work. You could say that this book, in some ways, is a search for Frank Lloyd Wright's humanity. And I respectfully suggest that so many previous Wright chroniclers, historians, biographers have wished somehow to neglect that fundamental aspect of his humanity.
One thing that can't be denied is that he affected many people's lives, whether it was through his homes, his work. Of course, as you mentioned, his life was kind of surrounded in scandal at points with his personal life. He left his first wife and children. How do you balance those and take those into account?
It's so difficult to balance. All of his children suffered immeasurably at his hands. He had a total of 7 children, 6 by his first wife. All of them had extremely pain, difficult lives because of the psychic force of the father. He does this seeming unconscionable thing of abandoning his family and his children, the youngest of whom was just a little boy in 1909, just as his lover, Mema, who was his client, she abandoned her 2 children. So you would say, gee, you're making a case for this man's humanity when he does this. You know, you see things in his writings. He says, as if he's hanging himself with his own noose, he says, I've always had the father feeling for my building. I'm not sure I've ever had the father feeling for my children. I mean, how would that make you feel if you were a child of Frank Lloyd Wright and read that? No matter how, even if you had passed in your seventh decade at the time you read that, it doesn't matter. I've never quite had the father feeling for my own children. I do have the father feeling for my buildings. There's a lot you have to forgive in Frank Lloyd Wright. Yes, he built these grand prairie houses. He wanted the fame. He wanted the money. That was the route. That was early on. But there was a part of him, I believe, that always remained a small town boy with rural agrarian values who wanted to build shelter for the common man. Now, isn't that a decent and worthy impulse? That's why the vast bulk of his work is domestic. It's housing. It's not public monuments. It's not train stations. And this sense of wanting not only to build American architecture, but democratic American architecture, I think wanting to do that, you have to pollute it with all of his ego, and that he was building these buildings for himself, in a sense, for his own aesthetic particular purpose he was serving at that moment. Not all of it is mixed together. But I do feel that there's a worthy impulse that has to be looked at when you want to create dignified human shelters for ordinary Americans. What is not to admire there? What is not to defend there in terms of someone's humanity?
One thing you mentioned is that at heart he was a rural Wisconsin boy. And as you know, as people know, Wisconsin was his home. He built here, returned here. Even if he spent some time away doing projects, he always returned here. And you quote that he said, "Wisconsin soil has put the sap into my veins." So
isn't that beautiful? That's so beautiful.
It is. And you growing up not too far away from here, but I'm sure visiting his places here in Wisconsin. How have you found your visits here and seeing his work and connecting with him in that way? Do you look at his buildings and legacy differently now? And should we the next time we see one of his pieces of work?
I'm a native Midwesterner myself, having grown up in Kankakee, Illinois, and then later in the Illinois suburb. Chicago is sort of my hometown. He thought of himself as an old Madison boy. That's what he called himself at one point, an old Madison boy. Nothing made him happier than returning to those rounded bluffs near the Wisconsin River in southwestern Wisconsin, on that hillside of his Welsh forebears, those Lloyd Jones Valleys out in the Wyoming Valley and Helena Valley of Spring Green. No matter how widely worldwide he traveled, nothing made him happier than coming back. And I do feel you can get a sense of what he always preached. That is, that these works of his needed to kind of grow up from the ground itself. They had to come out of the ground searching for the light. And I think a Wisconsinite can take particular pride in that, and a Wisconsinite can get a particular feeling for what he means by that, that these works are indigenous to the land, the soil, the riverbank. It was as if they all grew up together in some long ago ice age. and they sprung right from the ground upon which they were built.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you for your time, not just today, but all of the time and dedication you have put into this work about Frank Lloyd Wright.
Thank you very much.
Paul Hendrickson is the author of Plagued by Fire, The Dreams and Furies of Frank Lloyd Wright. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of his event to talk about his book tonight at Boswell Book Company. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.